The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. From the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 845 for this August 7th, 2022. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your call shortly at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number, and you can text us your comments and questions at 580-580. So in preparing for the show today, I was just reviewing the news, as I usually do, and came across a common theme that I think a lot of people are just reaching a point where they're fed up and just about to throw in the towel and say it's just too much already. And that has to do with infectious diseases, as well as the destruction of our healthcare system, and the inability of our politicians to seem to be doing the right thing. And so some of these issues, we're seeing polio come back, West Nile virus appear a bit earlier. We've always got COVID. There's now monkeypox, which is now considered to be a global threat. You have climate change that is increasing the range of mosquitoes northward that can carry malaria, dengue fever, Zika, shortages in the emergency rooms. Right, you've had the Montfort recently, just today, saying they're closed again from 7 till 7, 7 in the evening till 7:30 in the morning today again. You have Carleton Place that has shut down their emergency room, 2 weeks shut down in July for Glengarry in Alexandria. Perth emergency room was shut down for 3 weeks in July. And we still have politicians who are too craven to do their jobs or allow others to improve access to services. And let's deal with each of these things, because they are interesting because of how misinformation also impacts how we approach these problems. Now, Wesley Hazlett, he's a freelance journalist and also president of the Post Polio Network in Manitoba, who contracted polio when he was 13 months old in 1953 and now needs a power wheelchair and other aids to function during the day, wrote an article just recently on the CBC website. And I'm not reading the whole article, but there are certain passages in it that I'd like to read and go through each of these items as well. You know, talk about West Nile virus, climate change, the resurgence again of polio, where he says quote, I cannot imagine seeing thousands of children being kept alive on ventilators and overwhelming hospitals because of a disease that is easily preventable with the course of a proven vaccine and booster. Now, why is this coming up? Well, because in New York State, there was a, in 2 weeks, just 2 weeks ago, the New York Health Department reported in the U.S. their first case of polio in almost a decade in Rockland County, north of New York City. It occurred in a healthy young adult who was unvaccinated and developed paralysis in their legs. Since then, three positive wastewater samples from Rockland County and four from neighboring Orange County were discovered and genetically linked to the first case. This was from the health department, and that suggests that the polio virus is now being spread within local communities. And the health department states, quote, based on earlier polio outbreaks, New Yorkers should know that for every one case of paralytic polio observed, there may be hundreds of other people infected, State Health Commissioner Dr. Mary T. Bassett said. Coupled with the latest wastewater findings, the department is treating the single case of polio as just the tip of the iceberg of a much greater potential spread. As we learn more, what we know is clear, the danger of polio is present in New York today. And according to the health department in New York, about 60% of children in Rockland County have received three polio shots before their second birthday, as have about 59% in Orange County, both below the 79% statewide figure. And normally you need to have 90 to 95% vaccination coverage. So you have a whole slew of children potentially at risk of contracting polio. And the vaccine is 99% effective in children who receive the full four-dose regime. And it has, think about this, it has rarely appeared in the U.S. since it was declared eradicated 40 years ago. So why is this happening? And what does Wesley Hazlitt say, continue to say? He said, due to massive uptake of polio vaccines starting in the 1950s, polio has been largely eradicated in North America and most areas in the world. Most polio survivors are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, but many of us who have recovered from the immediate paralytic effects of polio have gone on to develop post-polio syndrome, which has led to new paralysis, weakness, muscle and joint pain, and difficulty swallowing and breathing. We now require new supports and treatment to continue living. And he says, with the advent of COVID-19, those who oppose vaccination have used their new platform to misinform and create doubt in parents about the safety and efficacy of the polio vaccine. And also, due to the impact of COVID-19 had on access to our medical community, many children have missed out on their normal course of vaccinations for childhood diseases, and that includes the polio vaccine. He goes on to say, this coupled with the anti-vaccine sentiment in social media makes me concerned about the new spread of this debilitating disease that can cause paralysis and death. Chances are you don't know anyone who's had polio as a child or adult because the vaccines have been effective in eradicating it in Canada and most other countries in the world. So that's what's going on in New York. And if you think it's going to stay in New York, it isn't. This is an extremely contagious disease. It's found in the wastewater, and also because of the fact that people are moving around, it's highly contagious between people, and there are pockets in the U.S. and pockets in Canada of communities where vaccination rates are not as robust as they should be, and I don't think this is going to be the last case of polio that we're going to be seeing, and that to me is just, it's just should never have happened. Should never, ever, ever have happened. And then we're dealing with issues pertaining to, let me just take a look here. Yeah, we did that. Issues pertaining to mosquitoes. And you think, well, what do mosquitoes have to do with it? Well, because of climate change, we are starting to see more and more mosquitoes and a northward expansion of mosquito populations. This is coming from Manisha Kulkarni, medical entomologist and associate professor at the University of Ottawa, says, quote, it certainly seems anecdotally that it's a big year for mosquitoes. Quote, we had a warm, wet spring, which seems to help the proliferation of mosquitoes in the early season. And with the humidity that we've been having and the high temperatures, that's likely to persist into the summer months. Warmer weather and amid climate change means Canada could be in for longer mosquito seasons, which typically run from May to October each year. And if mosquitoes are active for a larger portion of the year, that poses a bigger risk to human, wildlife, and animals susceptible to mosquito-borne diseases, says Kulkarni. So a study that was published in The Lancet last year predicted that rising global temperatures will increase the what they call climatic suitability of malaria and dengue fevers, particularly in already endemic areas in the African region, the Americas, and Eastern Mediterranean. And they say that the population by 2070, the risk of both diseases might increase by up to 4.7 billion people by 2070. And globalization and the climate crisis have also given rise to new vectors, so new infections and carriers entering Canada that did not exist before, said Rosalind Murray, an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. She says, quote, "We are starting to see new species of mosquitoes, and with those species, we might start to see new diseases that they can carry or an influx of different types of diseases." So again, you look, listen to all this and you just want to run and hide under a rock. You've got monkeypox that's now a significant threat in the world, climate change issues, shortages in the emergency room, closures in the emergency room, infectious diseases that we haven't seen in decades come back, new diseases, well, not necessarily new, but diseases that were tropical in nature now moving northward because of climate change, and nothing, crickets from public health, crickets from health ministries in our government, both federal and provincial, to deal with these issues. And these are issues that can be dealt with. So although it seems overwhelming, there's vaccinations for polio, there's vaccinations for monkeypox, there's vaccinations for COVID. There are treatments for viral treatments, antiviral treatments for monkeypox and for COVID. There are prevention measures you can use for West Nile virus. There's avoiding mosquitoes at specific times and educating people and letting them know what they can do, right? Mosquito repellents, sure. Knowing that mosquitoes are most active between dusk and dawn. So just sort of, if you can, avoid going out at those times when mosquito populations are heavy. There are prevention of mosquitoes in your area. There are companies that will spray the area with environmentally friendly products that will prevent mosquitoes from coming around your deck. If you're able and have the ability to do that, that work extremely well. There's also understanding that certain people attract mosquitoes more than others. So for example, bacterial colonies on your skin and the amount of carbon dioxide we produce affects that. And more that you're breathing, which you have to breathe, being active, waving around attracts mosquitoes. Wearing darker clothing attracts mosquitoes. So if you wear lighter clothing, that makes it you less of a target. And also drinking alcohol makes you more of a target for mosquitoes. So, and using repellents that have DEET will prevent that. So the bottom line to all of this, and you know, there's a lot more, but I think you're getting the general picture, is that although you have all these things happening, they seem to be happening all at the same time, and you just throw up your hands and you say, I just don't want to deal with this anymore. It's too much. Ignoring it doesn't make it go away. Ignoring it gives a chance for misinformation to take hold. Ignoring it takes away some of the impetus from the government to act on things. And so make a lot of noise, take control of the situation. There are vaccinations for certain things. If you're at risk of monkeypox, there are vaccinations for it. But there are things that can be done. It's not as if we are helpless. We are only helpless if we make ourselves helpless. And that's partly because of misinformation, partly because of fatigue, but nevertheless, ignoring the misinformation, countering it with facts, understanding what is actually going on, and holding our governments to account to enact things that protect us, which is what their job is to do, will go a long way to safeguarding what we seem to think as now a flood or a deluge of things that are occurring to us. We're going to take a small break and come back with your calls. Our lines are almost full at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
used to say, live and let live.
You know you did, you know you did, you know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.
Talk 521-8255 star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number, and your comments and questions at 580-580. We're going to go to line one and speak to Ruth. Hi, Ruth. Ruth, are you there? I cannot hear Ruth. Can't get Ruth on. Okay, we're going to put Ruth on hold. Can you put Ruth on hold and just see? Okay, we're going to put Ruth on hold. Something is going on with the phone lines, so we're going to try and see what's going on with that. So until we get the phone lines going, I'm going to cover some of the other stuff and some of the... Okay, let's try again. Ruth, can you hear me?
Hello?
Oh, there we go. Hello, Ruth.
It's Ruth. It's yes.
We have daylight. That's good.
You're asking me how I am. I'm sopping wet. We just had a big downpour about an hour and a half ago with very strong winds.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and heavy, heavy rain. I'm in a high rise. All my flower pots were filled up to the top
wow.
with water. I've been emptying, drying this out. I no sooner got them dry, it just let loose again.
I didn't cycle in today for exactly that reason, because it was pouring when I'm supposed to leave from home, which is usually around 1:30, but it was pouring, and then the streets are all puddled and stuff, so I had to drive in instead, which bothers me. I like to usually cycle in, but I know the deluge. So we had the same kind of deluge.
Well, especially if it's your flower pots and they spill over on your neighbors down below, so you hear about it in the high rise, right? Anyways, I had a quick question.
Sure.
I heard earlier this week, it was on Morning Rush, I can't remember if they read it or somebody called in about it, but they said if you drink too much milk, it can cause depression. And I've never heard that, and the people on air said they didn't hear about that yeah. before. Have you heard of that?
No, there's really nothing that I'm aware of that how, whenever there's a claim, for any kind of claim, the one thing, the first question that always goes through my mind is, what is the biological mechanism that would explain something like that? How does that actually work if it was to work? Because really, you're just talking about a food that has compounds in it that are very similar to other foods that you eat. So what would make milk inherently so different? And given that depression is worldwide and that 90% of the world population doesn't drink milk because of lactose intolerance, it'd be pretty big stretch for a claim to come and say that drinking too much and what defines too much that would cause depression. So I don't see how there would be a link to that and brain disorders leading to depression. I just don't see how that would be the case.
Okay, because I normally have a couple of glasses a day.
Yeah,
I've been doing that for a long time. So
yeah,
like you say, what's too much? And
yeah, I would be very careful.
I've never heard of this, and they hadn't heard of it either. So I just thought, okay.
Yeah, I'd be very careful about food claims in general. You know, you tend to see coffee will help you for this, or don't drink too much coffee, or this type of alcohol. If you drink this much, it seems to be helpful, and this much is too much, and this
will actually give you mental health just trying to keep up with the story.
it can be overwhelming. That's exactly right. So what I would say is there really nothing that I'm aware of that really says that milk causes... Now, I'm not a big fan of milk anyway. I think we tend to push it too much, especially for children, that they don't really need milk. But that's another issue altogether. But in terms of it causing depression, no, I haven't seen anything that contributes to that.
You could add that one to your medical myth.
Yeah, we'll do that with Bill. All right, Ruth.
Because yeah, they didn't know. They didn't know either when they were talking about it last week.
Right.
Or earlier this week, yeah.
Okay,
I'm going to go back to emptying out and dripping out my plants.
All right, good luck, Ruth.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye now. We're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we have lines are almost full, but we'll get to all your calls. Don, Mark, Irene, and Lori, we will have you on the air. I can guarantee that you will be on the air. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. back in a couple of minutes. Back to the phone lines, and we're going to speak to Don. Hello, Don.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
Well, I have problems with my knees. That's the reason for the phone call. Mm-hmm. I have osteoarthritis in my knees, and I've been looking for some pain relief, and one of the things I notice is there's getting a lot of publicity is the infrared heat lamps. And another question is, on TV, I notice there's a lot of advertising about this round pad you put on the floor and set your feet on it, and mm-hmm. it shocks your legs and knees. And also it comes with pads that you can place on your sore spots, and it shocks them. Is there any medical evidence that these devices provide any relief for joint pain?
Well, that's a really good question. So the first way I'm going to answer this is first deal with the what osteoarthritis represents in terms of what the mechanism of the disease is, what we call the pathophysiology, so how the disease actually occurs. So in our knees, a normal knee, the knee joint itself has, as the bones come together, so from the bottom bones, your lower leg, your tibia, and your upper leg, the femur, where they come together and form a hinge joint, you have cartilage on the surface of those bones that act as a very smooth, almost frictionless surface. And then you have a disc, or what's called a meniscus. It's like a C-shaped cup that allows the bones to fit into that, so they glide on that surface. What happens over time, and what osteoarthritis is a wear and tear injury over time that erodes the surface of the bone itself. So the cartilage that normally covers that bone, that is nice and smooth, that allows it to glide very easily, now starts to break down. And so instead of having a smooth surface, if you imagine what a nice, smooth, almost frictionless surface is, now imagine that surface sprinkled with sand stuck on the surface and the bone being exposed. And when you try to bend the knee, instead of having the smooth surface gliding, you now have this roughened edge that will grind against other surfaces, and that leads to pain and inflammation. So that's in a nutshell what the process is with regards to osteoarthritis. So now the key thing is to say, well, how can you treat that? Well, when there's bone erosion, which eventually happens with osteoarthritis, and when there is cartilage erosion, you can't get that back. There's no way to regenerate that type of tissue. So the inflammation will continue as long as the bone continues to be damaged, or the cartilage is damaged. Now, counterintuitively, what tends to help is being as active as possible. And the reason is that when you are bending your knees, you're increasing the pressure in the knee joint itself. And there's fluid in that knee joint. That fluid is called synovial fluid. And with increased pressure, that synovial fluid is needed to basically keep whatever cartilage is still there as healthy as possible. And so when you're using your knees, you are preserving some of that cartilage, but it doesn't last forever. And so you're faced with either medications to reduce the inflammation. So people usually use anti-inflammatory medications. Some people get injections in their knee. If the knee has mild to moderate osteoarthritis, they'll get steroid injections to reduce the inflammatory process. Some people will get what's called viscosupplementation, which doesn't really have a great track record, but it's essentially injecting the same kind of compound that's found in the synovial fluid to lubricate the joint and try to protect the joint a bit. So that's sort of the medical approaches. So if a claim is being made now that infrared can somehow help the joint, and you're asking a very good question, my answer would be, how does that actually help? Because infrared gets absorbed on the surface of the skin. It'll warm up the skin, but it's really not going to change the damage that's happened on the inside of the knee. And sometimes heat will actually cause more swelling because it increases blood flow. And that can actually cause more swelling within the knee joint itself, making things worse. Plus infrared, the question also is, how long is it applied to the knee? How close is it to the knee? Infrared also can cause burns because it not only will heat up the skin, it'll heat up what's underneath as well. And so that's not a, it's like putting your hand under infrared heat lamps, you know, over stoves where it keeps food warm. It can heat up to hundreds of degrees. So that's an issue too. So I don't know how much evidence there is. I haven't seen very much evidence that infrared is going to really help the knee joints, or applying your feet onto pads that may shock things, again, because the underlying damage done to the bone and the cartilage is not going to respond to anything like that. It's not going to regenerate that. As someone myself who has osteoarthritis of the knees, and I have had a partial knee replacement in my left leg because of that, depending on the severity of the osteoarthritis, I can tell you that one of the best decisions I ever made was having a replacement or partial replacement, because it gave me back the function of my knee and almost virtually eliminated the pain that I had. So those are some of the approaches to osteoarthritis. There is strengthening the muscles of the upper leg to help provide more stability to the knee. But really, it is a chronic condition. And if you're encountering advertisements that are promising or claiming that it's somehow going to reverse the process, I would, and it sounds like you are, I would be very skeptical about that.
Oh, this is very very educational. I have exercises that I do, and a bicycle.
Yeah, and that's fantastic.
So I understand that I should be exercising my knees.
And what I would suggest is if you speak to your physician too, if you're, you know, that there is a means of grading osteoarthritis, right? That's usually done by x-rays that'll tell you whether it's mild, moderate, or severe. They also will give terms such as, you know, the number of compartments that are involved. So there are three compartments in the knee. That is different locations in the knee that they will divide up. And they'll say, well, this compartment has severe osteoarthritis. This side does not. Some people with severe disease, they'll say they have tricompartmental disease, which means all three areas within the knee joint are severely affected. And depending on the degree of osteoarthritis, if someone has moderate to severe disease, they are debilitated, their quality of life is suffering, they can't function as well as they'd like to, then what I would say is that usually points towards surgical interventions where if knee function is really that bad. And so that's where speaking to your physician, getting proper evaluation done. If the evaluation points to severe disease, then there's a referral that's made to the Champlain Regional Hip and Knee Joint Assessment Center, where it's a central intake where they look at osteoarthritis and treatments for it. And even if it isn't that severe, a referral can still be made so that they can recommend certain modalities of treatment to, in addition to what you're doing now, to try to help alleviate some of the discomfort.
Okay, that's very good then. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Don. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now. We're going to take one more call, and let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark. Mark, are you there? I don't hear Mark, so we'll put him, can you put him back on hold? And what we'll do is we're going to take a small break and come back and continue with the calls. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Back in just a couple of minutes.
Came and left without warning. Thank you.
And going right back to the phone lines, and we are going to be speaking to Irene. Hello, Irene.
Hi. I just thought that I'd like to ask you something about gallbladder.
Sure.
I just recently found out, I've been connecting the dots about all the females, my siblings and that, and my grandmother and mother who've had gallbladder issues, and even their daughters had them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they had to have them removed. None of the males in our family ever had that issue.
Yeah, you tend to see gallbladder disease. It does tend to happen more in women than in men, and not in all cases. It does happen to men too, but it also, you can see that run in families. So your observations are very correct.
Like it just kind of like blew me away that like I found out like that three of my nieces, they all have it. I thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy. I'm the only one that didn't.
That's right.
That's what scares me.
Well, you have to remember that gallbladder disease is easily managed, right? There's likely a metabolic, meaning how your body processes different compounds and stores bile in the gallbladder and crystals that form in there. And it's just likely more often happening in your family for genetic reasons. It's just how your bodies are processing things, but it is manageable, right? So if you're getting pain and you check and you see there's gallstones, well, then usually you do surgery to remove gallstones if someone is symptomatic. If someone has some stones but they're not having any pain, you leave them alone because sometimes they can have stones for a long time, and you leave people be. So, but it is, it's, I'm not surprised that you're mentioning something like that. It does happen, but even though it's happening, it is very straightforward to treat. In fact, management now is even easier than what it used to be. That is, they use scopes now, laparoscopic surgery, as opposed to the major cut that they used to do to get to the gallbladder, which resulted in staying in hospital much longer. Now it's day surgery and the gallbladder is removed and people are fine. You can live without a gallbladder without any effect on your lifespan. But it is something to be vigilant about, especially if you're noticing it in your family.
Well, the thing is, like all the ones in my family that got it, they ended up with the surgery because they had the attack.
Sure.
There was like no awareness. There's no education. Like I just got a new family doctor. I'll be in September. So
yeah.
I think I need to put that on my family.
Yeah, just let them know what the family history is. Yeah, and that just keeps them aware. So if you start having pain in that area, then you do an ultrasound and you see if there's stones in that area. But yeah, it's an important family history thing to mention.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. It just kind of blew me away last week when I, you know, found out, like, you know, you would just ask. I went and asked Denise.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the way, if you ever had gallbladder issues, and she wouldn't answer me for a couple hours. And then she said, oh yeah, I did have, and it had it removed. Right. Like, so it's kind of fascinating.
It is very fascinating to see that happen in families. Not fascinating, oh, good, it's happening, but fascinating in that it's actually interesting to see how genetic conditions and how families pass things on from one to the other.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye now. And we're going to go speak to Lori. Hello, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. I had a question, Dr. Gorkin, about psoriasis.
Yes.
I have different variations of psoriasis.
Okay.
In different spots on my body. So, like, I've got it on my elbows, my forearms, my legs, my knees, my bottom, my fingernails, although you can't see it. I went to the, the light doctor there at the Civic.
Yeah.
And he said that I wouldn't be a good candidate for light therapy. And now the skin specialist wants me to get some sort of injection that you do yourself.
Yes.
But I've heard that the injections can cause leukemia.
Well, so, not really. I mean, for psoriasis, I have many patients with psoriasis. It's not something you should suffer with because it can be readily treated. The treatments for psoriasis in the past 5 years have exploded in terms of what is available. And they go on a graduated level. That is, you start off with certain medications. Usually you start off with topical agents and steroids and stuff, and then you move up the chain depending on how someone responds and how severe their psoriasis is.
Like it's like 40% of my body.
Yeah, and so if that's a lot, so that's severe.
Really visual.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's severe, and that causes a lot of suffering. So, the medications, you have to keep in mind that the medications that are used are immunosuppressive. So the injectable ones are usually immunosuppressive. Sure, they list leukemia as a potential side effect, but that's not what usually happens. It has to be taken into context. You always balance quality of life with risk. And it's not as if you're taking the medication and being told, okay, go away and just take your medication. There are blood tests that are done on a regular basis, as with any medication that's used, or is oral or injectable, that is used for treating psoriasis. There are blood tests that are done to follow someone on a very regular basis.
I've got to go have a liver thing. I've got to go have everything. Oh, I know.
Yeah, and so that should provide a little bit of comfort in that if something starts to happen, it can be intervention can happen earlier. But for the most part, and for most people, there's no leukemia, but it does give you a significant improvement in your quality of life, right? I mean, if 40% of your body is covered with plaques, that is you're not a happy camper, I'm sure.
No, and the oozing stuff, like down at the kneecaps and stuff, like people look at me like I've got friggin' plague or something.
Yeah, it's because it's very noticeable, and there's that aspect of it as well. So, I would say, Lori, if they're recommending medications to you, they would not purposely offer you a medication that would cause you harm. They have to disclose what some of the risks are. But ultimately, it is a treatable condition, and you really should not suffer to that degree.
Oh, okay. Now, can I ask you one more quick question? I know you're a busy man. I know
sure.
Like, I'm taking Duobry, and I'm taking this other spray stuff, and like I'm using the different cocktails of corticosteroids.
Corticosteroids,
right now.
Yes.
Is there something that I can try on my own, like from Cardish or something, or should I be using like tea tree oil or?
No, there's. I wish I could tell you that there was an easy solution that way, but again, you're dealing with an autoimmune condition where your body is attacking its own skin, and so using anything over the counter is really not going to address the problem. And so you really have to get. And like I was mentioning earlier in the show, the mechanism of the disease is that your body is attacking the skin, so you have to block the body from attacking the skin to allow the skin to heal. And so that's where those medications come in.
Why does the body do that? I'm sorry. Why does the body do that?
A lot of these are genetic, right? It's genetic conditions.
But nobody in my family has it. And like, I have COPD. Nobody has COPD. I've got it all.
Yeah. It's one of those things that occurs. It's not necessarily that it's going to run in every family member, but there may have been a gene that you inherited that only gets expressed under specific circumstances. And that's how that's happened. But whether it's from family or not, there is a treatment for it, and you should really take them up on the offer.
I will. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
You're very welcome, Lori. You too. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. That wraps up our show. My thanks to Steve Bunda for producing Sunday House Call and dealing with a board that was flooded with coffee earlier before the show. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Thanks once again for all your calls. Have a great week, and we'll be back again next week.